My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous from Miami, Florida. I haven't found it necessary to have a drink, nor have I had a drink since January 25th, 1981. It's a privilege to be here. I'm humbled to be here. I love this group. I like this group. This is a good group. I really liked what all the birthday celebrants said, and I particularly liked listening to Bob with 1 year. Was it Jim? Sorry. With 1 year. You know, sometimes I believe, I guess I'll be sober a little bit over 34 years, and sometimes I believe that I was closest to this deal the night I picked up my white chip, when I didn't know anything, and I was sitting in the back of the room, and it was with a group of people that didn't know me, and I got up from the back of the room, and I walked in a group like this, all the way forward, because they said, is there anybody who wants to pick a white chip to change your life? And I picked up that white chip. It's almost like saying, it's almost like saying that you need help in front of a group of people. Some people think it's humiliating, but you know, I read somewhere, I think in the seventh step, that humility is the basis of all these steps. And I don't know anything about humility. I was going to give my world class talk on humility, but I never do it with a group this small. But I know a lot about humiliation, and somewhere in the book it says the way we get a new perspective is because of things, something that's unbelievably painful, by 100 forms of humiliation in the final crushing of our self-sufficiency. And the only time I've really met God, the places I've met God, like they say in the book of James, is rejoicing in the trials. It's in the valleys. You know, when I have all the money and everything going my way, you know, all I'm doing is thinking about myself, which is my favorite activity. Because I don't know about you, but my alcoholism centers in my mind, not my body. You know, it has to do with selfishness and self-centeredness and being driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. I step on the toes of others. They retaliate seemingly without provocation, right? But I realize that in the past, I ultimately realize that in the past I've made decisions based upon self. Because it's all about me. That's all I want to talk about. I want to talk about me and my feelings. I'll tell you what I worship. I worship my feelings. I want to talk to you about my feelings. I'll listen to you for 5 minutes, and then as soon as you take a breath, I'm going to talk more about my feelings. Because you've got to understand how I feel, because I got a story. You got to listen to me. Didn't you know that's biblical? You got to listen to me. You know, my lovely wife is here. You know, I've got to tell you, here's the deal. I drank for about 15, 16 years. I came to AA when I was 31 years old. And I've been sober for a little bit over 34 years. And I'm not bragging, I'm just reporting. That's the deal. I mean, my sponsor's got 58 years. And not a record around here, but a record for me. And so I've been sober a little over twice as long as I've been, I was drinking. And you know, your story changes when you come to AA. When I first came to AA and I started telling my story, because I'm a lawyer by trade, you know, and I'm a paid bullshit artist. And I once said to a judge, I said, "Judge, I'll be brief." He said, "Mr. Spatz, you can say your name in 10 minutes." So, you know, I mean, but I'm going to explain a little bit more about the secret of this program in the third hour of this incredible talk. I'm talking to one person, I understand, or maybe at the diner afterwards. And so what happens is, when I first started talking, you see, I first came in, I give a drunk log, and there's nothing wrong with drunk logs, and it's great, and it's wonderful. It has good identification and remembering, and so my drunk log would be, you know, like 15, 20, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, whatever the heck it is, and then I talk about what happened, which would take about 30 seconds, and then I'd spend 5 or 10 minutes talking about what it's like now. And, you know, I've been road testing this thing through cancer, through bankruptcies, through foreclosures, through raising 4 kids, through being married for 34 years, you know, to, you know how she is, to a woman that doesn't understand me. So I've been road testing this thing, and I've been sponsoring quite a lot of people and working with myself and stuff. And so what my real desire, what my really heart is because I have a heart for new people, is to talk about the miracle of this program, the miracle of sobriety. So, you know, I tend to drift from time to time into a little bit of a drunk log, but you'll have to excuse me if I'm just going to talk about what's been going on with me for the last 34 years. You just have to take my word from me that I'm a drunk. You know, and that I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. I mean, that's the real disease here, you know. You know, self over and riot, though we usually don't think so. And says, above everything, we must get rid of this selfishness we muster. It kills us, and God makes that possible. I have a big book, and I read the big book, and I go by the big book, and it talks all about God. It says, see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. And so that's all I'm going to talk about tonight. I'm going to talk about God. And because I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know what fellowship you're in. I mean, just because you're in this room, I mean, just because you're sitting in the garage doesn't mean you're a Buick. And just because you're in an Alcoholics Anonymous room doesn't mean you're in the fellowship I'm in. I'm in a fellowship which has to do about see to it that there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. That you can't manage your way out of this. You can't think your way out of this. No person's going to get you out of this. They may help you from time to time, but only God could and would if he would saw it. You know, that's the fellowship I'm in. I'm in the fellowship where it says, first things first, we've got to quit playing God, whatever that means, and I had to figure out what that means. You know, the big book, you know, what I was told is, lesson until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, there's consequences to being an alcoholic. And all its consequences is sobriety be precarious and the true happiness, you'll find none at all. And I'll tell you what, I don't want precarious sobriety. I want what they promised in the big book. I want to be rocketed in the fourth dimension and experience much of heaven. And that, so that's what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about that stuff because there are people who need to hear that stuff because I sponsor guys with 25 years sobriety and the thumb-sucking crybabies, although you wouldn't know because they know how to do the AA bullshit in the room. They know how to talk this shit. They're on their 14th married and their marriage, and they run around looking for a piece of ass. They're thinking that'll solve their problem, or, you know, or maybe a new car, something like that. And they're as miserable as the day they walked in here, you know, because it's all about them. It's all about themselves because they're shitty inside, and they're driving cars just like I used to drive in cars. And they hear the voices: "You're a piece of shit. You ought to kill yourself. You'll never make it." And they turn around and say, "Who's talking to them?" And they're the only one in the car. I know about those voices, you know. My wife is, I don't know if my wife is here. By the way, I want to acknowledge my lovely current wife. I like to call her my current wife. Keeps her on her toes. And are you, oh, there she is in the back of the room. Oh, there she is. A lovely woman. She's a, we've been married 34 years. She's a, you would be surprised how great a marriage can be once I realize that I'm always wrong. And I don't argue, you know, I just say, you're right, I am the worst husband in the world, and I never do anything for you, and I just ask her what the fine will be, because it's always, it's like a blouse or something, it's always something. She's a member of, she's royalty, and down in Miami, she's in Al-Anon. She's one of the honchos down there in Al-Anon. I'm what's referred to, if I go to an Al-Anon convention, I'm her qualifier. In other words, her life is miserable because of me. I made her what she is today. You know what Al-Anon is? Al-Anon is millions and millions of people all over the country that are sick and suffering because they met us one day. You know what I mean? Because that's how freaking toxic we are, you know? She does the great Al-Anon 10 stuff. When I'm wrong, she probably admits it. You know, I have six grandchildren, and one of them, the smallest one, is Andrea. She's like 6 years old. She's cute as a button. And so I'm sitting there in the computer in the office in my house, and all of a sudden Andrea comes walking up to me. She says, "Grandpa," he says, "What kind of fish are you?" I said, "I'm sorry, what, Andrea?" He says, "What kind of fish are you?" I said, "I don't know, Andrea. What kind of fish am I?" She says, "You're a selfish." I said, "You've been talking to Grandma." Oh, Lord. No, well, you know, I got these guys. I know there's some guys that have been listening to some tapes. I got these, you know, when I come from Florida. In Florida, let me just preface this. I'm going to do this little deal so I can tell you what's going on. In Florida, we have these things in Dade County and Broward County. We have these things called step series. Ever since I've been sober, ever since 1981 when I came in, I would go to step series. And what they do in Florida, and this may be new to some of you, I know some of you guys listen to the tapes, is they'll take somebody who has like 10, 15, 20, 30 years, whatever it is, and who's respected, who, you know, this program is respected, and he's into the big book, he's into our program, and the groups will give him 12 weeks, and every week, like on Thursday, Friday, whatever, he'll have an hour, and he'll basically say, this is an hour on step one, an hour on step two, an hour on step three, and you do it for 12 weeks. It's almost like ordering a college course on the steps. And so there would be these men, like Eddie Edwards, like Joe Snyder, like Ray O'Keefe. There'd be these men that would do these three-month courses where, you know, like hundreds of people would go to just listen to them on their take over a period of 3 months. on the steps. And I would follow these guys around. The miners, some of you guys heard the miner story, which I won't tell tonight, but the bottom line is I would follow these guys around. You know, Keith is doing the steps, and this one's doing the steps, and that one's doing the steps. And so I would listen to these guys, and you're basically getting 12 hours of these guys with 20, 30 years, you know, talking to you about their experience, strength, and hope, and how they did the steps, and how they worked out this stuff. And 90% of the stuff you didn't understand, but it would just be in there in the room. It would come upon you. You would hear this, you know, you'd hear the solution. You'd hear some stuff, and you'd aspire some things. And it was incredible, and that's the way I was brought up. And I thought, we had speakers meetings and discussion meetings, you know, thumb-sucking crybaby meetings, and, you know, my mother doesn't understand me, my father doesn't understand me, whatever, I think I'm, you know, all that stuff. But the bottom line is that it was the speakers meetings that I lived for, because I wanted to hear the solution. I wanted to hear the deal. I wanted to hear about the miracle. And I thought that's the way it was all over the country, because in Dade, Broward County, they happen all over, they even happen today. And it was about 5 or 10 years into this deal when I started traveling around and going to different parts of the country that I realized they don't have it anywhere in the country. That they're all basically discussion meetings or they're speakers meetings, and that's it. There's no guys doing the steps. And so now I happen to come up here and, you know, a lot of the, and so I do, now I do a lot of these step series all over Dade and Broward County and all over the place. So I get to speak to groups like this over a period of 12 weeks. You know, 12 hours, you know, 12 weeks. So apparently, so I come up here and what happens is when you're on the internet or something like that, is you never know who's going to, you never know who's listening to it. You have no idea. Every once in a while somebody writes you from England or something and says that we're listening to your tape. And so I come up here and I meet, you know, Keith, or I meet John here, Chris, or somebody like that who's listening to stuff, or Richard's over there, and different guys, and they say, no, I want you to do the chicken on the roof. I want you, because they all have their, you know, they've been listening to the step series. So they say, I want you to do the chicken of the roof, and I want you to do the Camaro story, and I want you to do, you know, all these different, I want you to do the miner story, and I want you, and I tell them, I said, listen, you've just listened to 12 hours of talks that I've, 12 hours that I was talking to a group, and you want me to fit that into 45 minutes. And I can't do that. So I'm just going to speak from the heart. I'm not going to be able to do everything that, you know, I've been asked to do and all that sort of stuff, but I just want to sort of read some things and talk to you about some stuff that I think is important about sobriety and the deal. I want to read something from the big book, so, you know, no matter how bad I am tonight, I mean, listen, I learned something a long time ago when I was about 3 years sober about the 12-step and carrying the message. You know, as a matter of fact, I think I'll tell the chicken on the roof story, because that's how I learned that it's a good place for it. I was doing a step series in Homestead, Florida, and I was about 3 or 4 years sober, and I was talking to a group, and it was, you know, about half this size, and I was talking, and I don't know what it was, you know, it was just one of these things, you know, where I didn't feel like I was getting across, I didn't think I was doing a good job, you know, when you're an alcoholic, if there's one thing you are, is you're self-centered, you're worried about what other people think about you, and, you know, that's what you do, you spend your entire life worrying about how you look and what other people think about you, and because you're always thinking about you, and you're convinced everybody else is thinking about you, and all you do is worry about you and think about you, and then after thinking about yourself and thinking about you and what it all means for about 10 hours, then you say things like, "I don't give a shit what other people think about me." And you spend your whole life going back and forth. What about me? What do I look? You know, me, 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 me. You know, what's your name?
Jennifer.
Yeah, me, I say, Jennifer, let's talk about you. What do you think about me? You know, I mean, it's all me. It's all me. It's all self, me. I dated a gal named Lynn in college, and I was in love, because if you're an alcoholic, you know, I didn't know anything about love until I was about 5 or 6 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought love had to do with getting laid, or had to do with lust, or had to do with having somebody on your arm to make you feel better because you're such a piece of shit. You have to have somebody. If you have somebody that adores you, you think you may be worth something. I didn't know what love was all about. But I was in love with this gal named Lynn. Every girl I went out with, I was in love with. I was in love with Lynn. We saw each other night and day for 1 year. She was a student at the University of Miami, and she was from New Jersey. And it was that real alky love, you know what I mean? I'm always thinking about her. Who is she with? What is she with? What is she doing? Well, some people call it love. Other people call it stalking. But the bottom line is, I'm sure you're laughing. You don't know what it's like. But in any event, it's that obsessive, you know. And so she told me one day. She says to me, She says, you know, my parents, I've been down here for a year, they've been subsidizing. My parents want me to come up, would like them to spend Christmas, she came from Totowa, something like that, Christmas with them for about 2 or 3 days up here. And the girl I was in love with, I was giving my life to, I mean, she wanted to leave and go to Totowa for 2 or 3 days. And I got this rage. And I looked at her and I said, but what about me? See, that's what I know about love. I know you scratch the surface of every thought I have, every motivation I have, where you think it's virtuous or not, it's always goes down to what about me? It's all about me. It's all thinking about me, no matter what I'm doing. You know, I can get rid of the drinking, I just don't know how to get rid of the thinking. You know, it's like being right-handed. How do you get rid of being right-handed? They tell you if you do it with your left hand, you'll be okay. If you do the right hand, you're going to die. But I've always been right-handed. I do it automatically. I don't even think about it. I automatically think about it. I've only thought about me all my life. I've only felt, I've only perceived this way. I've only think about things all my life. For me, it's not only not unusual, it's comfortable to think about me. It's comfortable to feel self-pity. It's comfortable to feel sorry for myself. It's comfortable when I say, I don't believe this crap is happening to me. When I'm sitting in a car jam with 10,000 cars, I say, why is this always happening to me? You know, it's comfortable. Everything is about me. They don't know who they're screwing with. You know. Every statement I make, it's all me. It's all about my feelings, and that's the only thing I want to talk about. So how do you get rid of that? You know, and I'm an alcoholic. I didn't even experience alcoholism until I got sober. I experienced something called drunk. I wouldn't give alcoholism a shot. I drank because no woman, no suit of clothes, no car, no job, no amount of money, no nothing worked as well or as fast as just a few drinks of alcohol. That's why they say men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They're restless, irritable, and discontented, sober, unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And that's why I drank alcohol. And I stopped drinking alcohol because the sad news is alcohol doesn't work for me anymore. Boy, if it worked for me the way it worked for me when I was 18, I'd still be drinking it. But it don't work for me anymore. And the real sad news about that is it stopped working for me about 10 years before I realized it stopped working for me. I hurt a lot of people. And so I'm sitting there in that group in Homestead, and I make a lot of right turns, and you know, you'll see. Anybody ever see Pulp Fiction where they start in the middle and they go to the end? That's what you know. I'll be talking about something, I'll go off someplace else, I'll come back, and I'll probably forget where I'm going. But I was back in that group in Homestead, Florida. I'm doing this stuff, and it's just apparent to me that they're not getting it, or I'm not coming across, or it's not happening, or whatever it is. And I just didn't get the love, you know, the love connection, or whatever it was. And as I left there, it was the worst. I gave the worst. Four-step meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. The worst four-step. I left the room. I was supposed to do like 8 more steps, and I decided I was going to go back again, you know. Because if you're an alcoholic, you know, they say, what did I say? Unless until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious and true happiness is fine. One of the consequences of being an alcoholic is if you're an alcoholic, you're a please love me a holic. Please accept me a holic. Please make me feel that you really like me a holic. You're also an excuse-aholic. There's a lot of holics going on if you're an alcoholic. There's a lot of shit going on, let me tell you. There's a lot of stuff going on in that brain, you know? And so I said to my, and I'm driving, I said, I ain't going back to that place. Those people didn't like me, and I didn't like them. I was on the cross. It wasn't working for me. It was the worst thing. I just did the worst thing in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you know anything about alcohol, and you know, all we do is think about people and what they're thinking about me, and we're sure they're all thinking about me. They're telling everybody else, hey, that guy's the worst thing in the world. And all of a sudden, you know how the way we think, and you're up to 3 o'clock in the morning sucking your thumb, and you know, nobody's thinking about you. You're the only one's thinking about you, and that's what you're doing, because that's the nature of the disease of alcoholism. Me. You know, obsessing about me. But, you know, the good thing is that I had one great thing going for me. The one great thing I had going for me is I didn't want to drink. No matter how bad things were, no matter what was going on, I didn't want to drink. I was more scared of drinking than anybody else. My sponsor used to say, Russell, there's no thing so bad that can happen in your life where a drink can't make it worse. And I'll tell you, you're asked to do a lot of crap in Alcoholics Anonymous that seems stupid. You don't want to do it, but the bottom line is somehow you believe that somehow you don't do it, you might drink. You'll do this stupid shit, you know? You'll do some stupid stuff, you know? Even though your sponsors are stupid and they don't understand and all that sort of stuff. And I somehow knew at that time, my sponsor had imbued in my mind that when somebody asks you to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, you always say yes. You know, because he knew that, you know, he knew I knew how to make this, you know, be, I would say things, you know, he was speaking alcohol code like, I'm not ready, which is code for I'm scared shitless. You know, they won't like me and I'm worried about them and I'm worried about what they'll think about me and I'll be humiliated even though I don't give a shit what they think about me. You know what I mean? And what you realize is people that say to themselves or say to other people, I don't give a crap what other people think about me, all they do is think about what other people think about them, because people that really don't give a shit about what other people think about them don't say I don't give a shit about what other people think about me. They say things like pass the salt or I'll take it, they'll add some more ketchup, but they don't say that shit. You know what I mean? And if you're an alcoholic, all you do is tell yourself every day, I don't care what they think about me. So you won't have to kill yourself. That's what drinking alcohol is. That's what drinking alcohol is. It's just committing suicide. You know, Carl Menninger said in 1930, when the Big Book was written, he said in his book, Men Against Himself, in the chapter on alcoholism and alcoholics, he said, alcoholics are men and women who are out to destroy themselves. Because when you know you're a piece of shit, you see, my problem was I was a nothing. It didn't matter that I graduated law school, fundamental honors in mathematics, National Foundation, it doesn't matter, you know, the fellowship, National Science Foundation Fellowship, all that stuff, I was going to nothing. No matter what I had in my life, deep down inside, I was a nothing. I was always going to be a nothing, I was going to be anything, but I was just a nothing. I used to put something in my body, it turned me into an almost. When you're a nothing, almost is top of the world. And so I got all these feelings and all this stuff going inside of me. And you know what happened? When I used the alcohol is when alcoholism, whatever alcoholism is, whatever that feeling is, you know what alcohol is, you know, I used to say things like, anybody ever say anything like, I need a drink? When I said I needed a drink, I wasn't like fooling around. I wasn't like saying, well, wouldn't it be nice? I was saying, pull the damn car over. I need a drink. I used to feel better driving up to the bar when I knew the booze was coming. I need a drink, you know. And so I'm sitting there, you know, and so I never gave alcoholism a chance, really, when you think about it, because it could be 15 miles away. It could be in New York City. It would be over there, and I'd say, I need a drink, and I'd drink it away. Alcohol was what I used, was the best substance I used to get rid of the alcoholism, which, by the way, happens when you're sober. Anybody here sober? Well, you got a problem. Listen, if you're an alcoholic, sobriety's not really a good deal. It's painful. Yeah, I'll tell you, if it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you can't get to sleep, and you got a million voices going around in your head, and they're all saying bad shit about yourself and other people, don't worry about it, you're just an alcoholic. That's what it is. You know, sometimes when you're sober about 6 or 7 or 8 months or 9 months, all of a sudden you'll say to yourself, now I know why I freaking drink. Now I know why I drank. Now I know why I drank. And so what I used to do is, the great thing about drinking is, it's like, because then you don't think about drinking, you just think about killing yourself. You just go for a long extended period of time thinking about putting a bullet in your brain or killing yourself or dying or something like that. But if you're like me, you want to kill yourself, but you don't want to die. You just don't want to be around like Woody Allen. You want to be around when it happens. So what you do, what alcoholics do, is we kill ourselves. We die. We drink. So we can die. But the great thing is you die, you see, because you get off the planet and you die and you kill yourself, but you get to wake up the next morning. It's like committing suicide, sort of. It's like a coward's way of committing suicide. And God knows if I'm anything, I'm a coward. I'm filled and riddled with fear. But this is just my alcoholism. It doesn't have to be with you. It's just the way I am. You know, and that's the thing I got to battle. Then all of a sudden, now the stuff that I'm using, now I can't use it anymore. And you know what? When I said no woman, no amount of clothes, no amount of money, no anything could work just as well as a few drinks, what you realize is that all the other shit works too. The women work, the gal work. The car worked, the money worked, it all works. And so I go from the booze to the gal to the car. Man, you're looking at a guy who spent more money I don't have buying shit I didn't need to impress people I didn't like. You know, because when you're empty inside and you got nothing and you always need something, I need, I have to have, I can't lose. It's all about gaining, getting something in you so that you're not such a piece of shit, because you know one thing, you ain't okay right here, right now. And so, what about that homestead group? So I knew that my sponsor, I knew that I could figure out an excuse, because I am an alcoholic. If you're an alcoholic, you're an excuseaholic. I'd tell them that my father was dying of cancer, you know, and I couldn't come back in because I knew they didn't love me and they didn't like me, and they were all thinking and talking about me, but because I had just done the worst four-step meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was only about 3 or 4 years sober, and you know, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. But I knew that because I had started developing something called integrity out of fear, I guess, because I knew that somehow if I made an excuse to not go back there, I might drink again, and I knew I didn't want to drink. So I went back there to that group, and I stood up before that group to do the fifth step meeting in this 12-step series, and some guy came up to me and said, "Can I talk to you for a second?" I said, sure. He says, "I just got to tell you something." He said, "The meeting you did last week saved my life." I said, "Excuse me?" He says, "The meeting you did last week saved my life." He said, "It was the greatest meeting I ever went to. It saved my life." He says, "You didn't see me. I was in the back of the room." He says, "My wife just left me. I lost my job. I only got, you know, 120 days, and I was going to actually drink, but I stopped the meeting. I stood in the back of the room, and he said, "You know, when you said the chicken was on the roof, the entire program came together for me. Everything came together for me. And I'm not in my head." And of course, I know I had never said the chicken was on the roof. Now, don't get me wrong. There was a part there. I knew what he was sort of talking about. There was a part there I was tossing a little poultry at. You know what I mean? I understood what part he was talking about, but I never said the chicken was on the roof. I said the turkey was in the basement. You understand what I'm saying? Now, of course, you got to think. I took credit for it. I said, you know, "Oh yeah, chicken on the roof." I always say that. Great stuff. You know, but you see, then I realized something. You see, this is what I realized. I realized something about Alcoholics Anonymous. What I realized is I was sitting up there thinking I was doing the worst meeting in the world. You know, I showed up to fulfill my responsibility, and I thought I was doing the worst meeting in the world. And I said, "Chicken was on the roof." And there was some guy in the back of the room that wanted to kill himself, and he was desperate. And he came in here trying to look for help, and he thought, maybe, possibly, this guy might help me. And he was sitting in the back of the room trying to think of anything, grasping at any straw, that maybe he might be able to stay sober that night. And I said, "Chicken on the roof." You know what I mean? And it went across the room, "Chicken on the roof, chicken on the roof." And God says, you know, when you want him enough, he always comes through. He said, "Your heavenly Father will never..." That's what Dr. Bob said. He said, "If you're an atheist or agnostic, have some sort of other intellectual pride that keeps you in this program, I feel sorry for you. Your heavenly Father will never let you down." And he came in here praying and hoping that something would happen, and it went across, "Chicken on the roof, chicken on the roof, chicken on the roof." And God knew what God does best. He knew that this guy needed in his heart. He needed to hear. They went across the room, turkey in the basin, and he knew this guy needed to hear chicken on the roof. And it went through his ear from turkey in the basin to chicken on the roof, and he got healed. And I get the credit. And I know if I'm doing a meeting that there's 200, and you know what I learned about that? That the 12 step isn't about carrying the message. A lot of people think it's about carrying the message. You know, if my job is to carry the message, it's a heavy burden. I got to worry about whether anybody drinks tonight, because then it'll be my fault. But the 12 step isn't about carrying the message. I didn't realize that until after I did that meeting. It's about trying to carry the message. See, all I got to do is try to do the best job I can. So this may be the worst meeting I've ever done in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's going to be the best meeting I can do tonight. And I know if there's 200 people in here, there's 200 different meetings going on. I've spoken to enough groups to know they come up to you, and everybody hears their one line, their one thing, their one deal, whatever it is they need. Some people get a 10th step out of it. Some people get a 3rd step out of it. Some people don't get anything out of it until 6 months down the road. And so that's why I'm so grateful to be here. And I want to read this, there's a couple things I want to talk about that I really do want to share a little bit about my sobriety. I got sponsored by a guy named, initially, Bob Sullivan. I've been sponsored by three. People say, "Will you be my temporary sponsor?" I said, "I don't know how to nail it and make it permanent." My first sponsor was a wonderful guy named Bob Sullivan, and he died after 9 years, and then Joe Snyder died after 15 years, and then John Glenn has been my sponsor ever since, and all big book guys and all God-fearing guys and all into that deal, and it's a wonderful thing. Unfortunately, I was supposed to be sponsored by... I came in here. I wasn't doing too well mentally. I had two neurons working. They were waving goodbye to each other. I was supposed to be sponsored by Albert Einstein or Jesus Christ or somebody like that. They weren't around, so they stuck me with this guy who was a used car salesman who never graduated elementary school. They didn't realize how brilliant I was. He was mean. He was. I was sponsored. My first sponsor. 9 years. He was abusive. I had an abusive sponsor who didn't understand me. You know, the problem is when you're an abused child, you end up being an abuser yourself. You understand what I'm saying? And so I got a little bit of that in me, and I, you know, he used to say some tough things. You know, I had him in my office one day. In my office, I have a wall like this, and it's loaded with plaques and diplomas and certificates from the Supreme Court and all this sort of stuff. And I looked at him, and I said, Bob, and I had about 4 or 5 months, I said, Bob, these are my degrees. And he looked at me and says, well, you know, Russ, rectal thermometers have degrees, and you know what they do with those. Well, I remember when I first started thinking, I didn't want to get overwhelmed with this deal, you know what I mean? I didn't want to lose, you know, when you get sober for a while, you start thinking about balance. You start thinking about balance, you know, you want balance. You don't want to get crazy with this AA. Let me tell you a little bit about balance when I was drinking. Here's how balance worked when I was drinking. I'd walk in the bar at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'd walk out at 4 o'clock in the morning. That's how I did AA. That's how I did drinking. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, drink 12 hours. It meant nothing to me to spend 12 hours in the bar while with a wife and a kid at home. 12 hours in a bar. I used to do that all the time. Didn't think anything of it. I come today, all of a sudden I start worrying about that. 3-4 meetings a week. I'm this is getting a little bit too much. I'm getting a little crazy. So I told my sponsor, I said, Bob, the same guy, the abusive one. I told my sponsor, I said, you know, Bob, I don't think I need to go to meetings on Thursday. I figured it out. I don't think I have to go to meetings on Thursdays. He said, well, no, you don't have to go to meetings on Thursdays as long as you never drank on Thursdays. Mm-hmm. Oh, man, he said, Russell, he says, you know as much about life as a dog knows about his father. Now, I got to tell you something. I graduated with Department 1 in mathematics. I was going for my PhD in algebraic topology. I graduated law school. I was the division chief for Janet Reno, the attorney general. And I was 31 years old, and I had never had anybody say anything close to me like that. Anything that was even close to that. So when he said to me, look at me, he says, you know about life more as much about life as a dog knows about his father. I looked at him because I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't even understand it. So I don't know how many, you got a lot of young people here. Anybody remember RCA, the RCA Victor, the logo? They have like a dog looking up at a speaker with a patch in his eye. So I immediately, because I'm trying to figure out with a word picture, what that, you know as much about life as a dog. So I'm starting to think of like a doggy family. You know, there's like a doggy father, a doggy mother, like doggy kids. You know what I'm talking about? And then all of a sudden, it's this, wait a second, a dog doesn't know his father. You know, I was thinking maybe he was complimenting me, you know, that kind of thing. He used to say to me things like, oh, Lord. One time I was sitting with a bunch of people. I had about 3 months of riot, and I'm sitting with three people at a table, and I was a bar drinker. Anybody here a bar drinker? So, you know, when you're a bar drinker, you know, when you're an alcoholic, first of all, when you're an alcoholic, you're given this certain inner discernment where you can tell, you can just recognize assholes, you know what I mean? I'd be here, and then there'd be some guy that walked in the bar on the other side, like 100 yards away, with some good-looking blonde, and I'd turn to my friend and say, look at that asshole, you know? You just know. And you know, you talk, I don't know what you guys did in bar, but my favorite activity was talking bad shit about other people behind their back. You know that guy, he's a jerk. Yeah, he's a jerk. You know, my wife's a jerk, you know, she's a big, yeah, you know, let me tell you who's a real jerk. This guy, your boss is a jerk. You don't know about my boss. You know, it's all about talking bad shit about other people. And so I'm sitting there in an A room, and all of a sudden, and they're sitting there, and all of a sudden these guys aren't talking. There's like silence. And you know, I always had to have something going. I had to have a TV on or a radio on. You know, somebody once told me you'll understand what sobriety is when you're driving a car without the radio off. I didn't know what they were talking about. I don't understand some of these because I'd never ridden in a car with the radio off. I've never been anywhere, because that's like being in silence, and that made me nervous, because my mind was always about bad crap about myself and other people, and maybe I had to have something distracting me. And all of a sudden, they stopped talking at the table. And so maybe I was uncomfortable with the silence, and you know, I had to say something, so I said something. I said, you know that guy, Bob, you know, that guy's really got a problem. And my sponsor stopped me. He says, you know, Russell, he says, I don't know what fellowship you're in. I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't say bad things about other people behind their back. So unless you have something good to say about somebody, why don't you just shut up? He didn't say, would you please be quiet? And I used to say to him, you know, I'm sensitive. He says, no, great artist is sensitive. You're just touchy. He said to me, why don't you just shut up? unless you have something nice to say about somebody. And you call, I'm an alcoholic now. I'm thinking about blowing up his house, raping his wife. He can't do that shit to me. Who does he think he is? You know, what kind of bullshit is this? You know what I mean? And that kind of stuff. But you know, the problem is, and I was like, my mind was like exploding. But you know what the problem is? They had that thing. I hadn't had a drink in 3 or 4 months. And I knew it had something to do with him. And you know, the problem is now I got this thing I don't want to drink. And he's my sponsor. And I respect him. And I know he loves me. But he said this thing. And he hurt my feelings. I don't know what to do. So what are you going to do when you're an alcoholic like that and you don't want to drink? What I did was I stopped talking bad shit about other people, especially when he was around. You know what I mean? I would. You ready for this? I would watch what was coming out of my mouth. And actually, what I would do is I would not only watch what's coming out of my mouth, but I found myself, you know, the kind of, and I actually stopped doing it because he humiliated me in front of other, you know. That's how we get a new perspective, by 100 forms of humiliation, final crushing of our self-sufficiency. You know, so he humiliated me. He hurt my feelings. You know what that means? That means I remembered. I remember. You know what I mean? It made an impression on me. It hurt my feelings. It made an impression on me. I don't know how you came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't come into here riding on the crest with $1 million in my pocket. You know what I mean? The best thing that ever happened to me happened at the heels of like what Jim was talking about. Winding up on my back and the urine and the blood and all that sort of stuff, you know? That's the deal, through the trials and the tribulations. And so I stopped talking, started watching what I said about, as a matter of fact, I became like the AA police. I'd hear somebody, I said, hey, this is AA, we don't talk that shit about anything. And so what happened, and you know, I like to talk, so you're sitting at a table with people, and you know, I'm just dying to say, I say, hey, you know that guy Bob? He says, yeah, he says, he's not a bad guy, you know what I mean? You know, like it forces you, if you want to talk, you got to talk good things about other people. And what happened is after a few weeks, I realized I started feeling better about myself. You know, I guess if my sponsor told me, you know, Russ, if you start cleaning up your mouth and talking good stuff about other people and thinking good stuff, then you're going to automatically start thinking good thoughts about other people. And if you start thinking good thoughts about other people and thinking good thoughts about yourself, you might actually feel better about yourself. Because maybe what you're all about is the shit that comes out of your mouth and the stuff that's going on in your brain. Maybe that's your real problem, which I think is something right out of Galatians or Philippians or something like that. Think on these things. Whatever's good, whatever's wholesome, whatever's right, whatever's of good report or something like that. Some guy named Paul said it a long time ago. So a long time ago, in 1939, they wrote this thing called the Big Book. But of course, AA started in 1935. You ever think about that? AA started in 1935. Did you know that? AA started in 1935? The Big Book was written in 1939, right? Right?
Right.
Is that right? I mean, you guys are Big Book thumpers, right? So here's the deal. In the Big Book, does your Big Book say what I said? Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That word thoroughly followed our path. A path, you thoroughly follow it. And we know there's one thing they didn't do, right? There's one thing we know in their path. They didn't read the Big Book, right? You know that. You know they didn't read the Big Book. If you don't know that, I'm going to have to explain that to you later on. In 1939, they wrote a book. They said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, and the path had nothing to do with reading the Big Book. And Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, it says, the books we found absolutely essential was 1 Corinthians 13, Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, and the book of James. We were almost called the James Club. This thing's been around for a long time. Says right here, we never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is a way of weakness, paradoxically is a way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. At once we commence to outgrow fear. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust the infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in a world to play the role He assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us, and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. God either is or He isn't. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things happened. We had a new employer, being all powerful. By the way, he's not a higher power. He's the highest power. He's all powerful. We had a new employer being all-powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. If we kept close to him and performed his work well, I guess you got to figure out who he is and what the work is he wants you to perform. Maybe getting laid or having a romantic relationship isn't what the work he wants you to perform. Maybe he wants to help you to help other people. Maybe he wants you to do service. Maybe he wants you to care about other people instead of worrying about your feelings and yourself. Maybe that's what he wants you to do. Instead of thinking about your own little plans and designs. I don't know. I'm just thinking, just talking. I don't know. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves and our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of His presence, to be conscious of His presence. What would it be like to be conscious of His presence, to always think about Him? What would it be like instead of thinking all those thoughts you think as you're driving your car, all those thoughts you think at 3 o'clock in the morning, what would it be like to always think about God? Just think about Him and what He wants you to do. We began to lose, I'll tell you what it says. It says we begin to lose fear. We began to lose fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter, we were reborn. What would that be like? That's probably why they say in the last chapter, they say, see to what your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. When did this book turn into a fellowship where people are scared to talk about God? They don't even want to use that name. They want to use higher power, and they don't even want to talk much about that because the hackles of their names. When did this change? When did this get melted down? You know, because it makes people feel bad or it scares people. When did religion get a bad, dirty word? I don't know what book you read. I read a book that says we begin to lose all prejudice, even against organized religion. We begin to see where religious people are right. I mean, that's the book I read. I don't know. I'm in a fellowship, you know. I can tell you. I don't know. I said to my sponsor, I said I was complaining about some of the things that was going on in the fellowship. He said, this isn't exactly Well People's Anonymous. This book. Tilted through a lot of crazy people, you know what I mean? Who really don't want to do it. Want to figure out how to excuse their way out of it and make it lighter. But you know, the problem is, I'll tell you what the problem is, what I found the problem is with my life. The problem with my life is you can lighten this thing up and you can not do it thoroughly and you can water it down, but unfortunately that doesn't change life. That doesn't change cancer. That doesn't change being fired. That doesn't change all the inequities, the vagaries of life and what can happen to you. And unfortunately, you know, it says, rarely have we seen a person fail or slowly follow this path, and you don't follow this path somewhere along the route. It might be a 5 years, it might be a 10 years, it might be a 15 years. You'll be empty as a shell. And that's what happened. That's how I learned about this stuff. That's how I learned about this stuff, through the pain, through going through the stuff. Because at 3 o'clock in the morning, after the doctor tells you have cancer, you know what I mean? At 3 o'clock in the morning, and you can't go to sleep because you're thinking about dying. You know, the Carl Gables group of Alcoholics Anonymous was not in bed with me, and my sponsor was not there with me. And nobody was there. It was just me, alone with my thoughts, with a wife and 4 kids. And the only thing I had to turn to was the God of my understanding. In the 4th edition of the Big Book, there's a chapter on Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, Bill Dotson. And Bill Dotson says this in the book, and I'm trying to do it from memory because it's not in this, this is the first edition. He said something, he says, I knew there was something more. He says, I knew there was something. I used to get this is the exact feeling I used to have. I would go to AA, I'd have 3 months, I'd have 6 months, I'd have 1 year, I'd have 2 years, I'd have 5 years, I'd have 10 years, and I'd always have before me somebody with 20, 30, 40 years or something like that, and I looked at them and I knew there was something more. So I knew, this is what it says in the book, he says, I knew there was something, this is what Bill Dotson says, Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, he was the man on the bed. Remember the man on the bed? You guys know what the man on the bed is? The guy in the t-shirt? You know, Bill Wilson is Dr. Bob is there. You ever see that painting? And Bill Wilson has open, you know what he has open? He doesn't have the Big Book open. He has the Bible open. And he's sitting there and he's talking to that guy. And he, what Bill Dotson said, he would have had, he was a few months sober. He had just gotten out of the hospital. And he was watching Bill Wilson and Dr. And he said, I knew there was something more, something I hadn't got. Something a person ought to have. Something a person ought to have to live with. And then he says, I was looking for the answer. I was trying to figure out the answer. And this is what he says, and you can check it out in your book. He says, Bill was talking to my wife. They're in the kitchen. They're eating tuna fish sandwich or something. His wife's name was Henrietta. This is not Henrietta Cyberlin. It's Henrietta Dotson. And he says this. He said, Henrietta, the Lord's been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I got to keep talking about it and telling other people. He said that line. Sometimes you'll hear something when you're like, 2 months sober, that will stick with you. He says, that line became the golden text for me. He says, Bill Wilson was very, very grateful. Very great, very, very grateful for his sobriety, and he gave God all the credit. And he loved, he was so grateful to God that he had to keep talking about it and carrying that message. The message that God had given him a gift of this sobriety. He said, that line has been the golden text for me. That's what Bill Dotson said on that deal. And that's been my deal. That's why I travel over. That's why I'll go anywhere, because that's the greatest thing. You know, I'm sitting with some guy in a diner, and he's got like about 2 weeks, and we just went to an AA meeting, and it's Denny's, and it's a Saturday night, and he's looking at me, he says, hey, that meeting was great, but it's 10 o'clock Saturday night, we're drinking coffee, that meeting was great, but what do you guys do for fun? And I don't have the heart to tell him I'm having a great time. Hey, buddy, this is AA Valhalla, this is it, man, you know, unbelievable. I didn't even tell you all the stories I wanted to say. I only got 3 million of them. I'm going to leave you with one story that I haven't... you know, when I say these are stories, it says your stories disclose in some way what used to be like, what happened, and what you're like now. Our stories are very important because it's how this program and how the Lord has worked in my life ever since I've gotten sober. You know, what happened is I have a beautiful wife who I've been married to for 34 years. I got the perfect wife for me. She beats me like a rented mule. If you know anything about me, you know, that's the kind of wife I need, you know, that's it, guys, you know, what can I tell you? You know, self-supporting by my own contribution most of the time, 4 kids that love me and respect me, I don't know why, because I'm a lousy father. All they've done is see me go to AA meetings and help other drunks, and for some reason, apparently I sponsor a lot of guys that think they should be friends to their kids, and I'd like to think my kids know I love them, but you know, they know that their father's out there trying to help other alcoholics and trying to stay sober and trying to do the right thing, and they know they can always call me up because I'll always be there if they need them, just like a fire, because I'm steady. You know, if you're not, alcoholics are not steady. Love is about being steady. And I started finding out about love. You know what I started finding out about love, about true love? When I first started sponsoring people and I actually honestly cared about what happened to them. When I was sitting in the audience of an AA room and some guy would say, I can't stop drinking, and I was sitting there hoping that he would pick up a white chip. Where for the first time I wasn't thinking about myself, I was thinking about somebody else. That's when I started experiencing about love. And then all of a sudden, out of this God thing comes into your life and you change and he transforms you. He does the transformation. That's what the sixth step is all about. That's what separates the men from the boys, when you're growing in the image and likeness of his creator. That's the program I'm in, where you humbly submit yourself. And you get down and you start realizing the value of suffering. You start realizing that even though you go through the suffering, if you turn towards him, that does the transformation in your mind. It's all about the suffering. Every bad, crappy, horrible thing that has happened to me in my life in 34 years that I've had to deal with and turned to God and has pushed me towards him has made me the man I am today. And I happen to be very grateful for the man I am today. Because I'm a good father, I'm a good husband, I'm a good friend, I'm a good sponsor. And I'm a loyal member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the Lord, and that's the deal with me. That's my deal. And I don't sit around worrying about what other people think about me, because there's only one thing that I'm concerned about, what that person thinks about me, and he's present here today, but you can't see him. But I can see him. I know who he is. So I'm driving in my car one day. So when I was about 15 years sober, I joined the church. And became a deacon, actually, in the church, which is pretty good for a Jewish kid from Long Island. In any event, yeah, you're laughing. You don't know where you're going to be in 15 years, so watch it. You know what I mean? So we started a ministry down there, and so I do a lot of things. I'm a lawyer, but I also do a lot of other things. And so I drive around, and I have the big book in my car, and I have the Bible in my car, and I got all sorts of stuff going on. And I'm going to leave you with this one story. It's a true story, and So where I used to live, we're living in a different house. There was a thing called Pierre's Dry Cleaners. You know, we're going to be out in time. This is like a 3 minutes or 4 minutes story. So Pierre's Dry, so don't get too nervous, okay? It's funny, when I was in the bar drinking, I never worried about the time. My wife would be at home, I never said, oh man, I only got 3 minutes, you know. People would leave. I'd say, where are you going? He says, my wife's drinking. I never understood why they would leave the bar. The booze was there, you know what I mean? And I would leave, I don't know. So I drove up to Pierre's Dry Cleaners, and actually you could see my house from Pierre's Dry Cleaners.
And there was this kid at the window taking the clothes, and his name was Leo. And I don't know how to explain this to you all. Maybe you all have seen this. I come from a different age. Leo was like around 16, 17 years old, 18 years old, something like that. He was a young kid, like 16 years old. And he had his pants. Now, I don't know how to explain this. His belt was here. Does anybody even understand what I'm talking about? Because I don't even understand what I'm talking about. I mean, this happened like 10 years ago, and I still don't know how they do that, where their belt would be down here. Okay? And he talked like this. He would say, he pointed at my car, because the Bible was up on the dashboard, and he said, I got one of those. That's what he did. I got one of those. He didn't say, I got one of those. He said, I got one of those. I said, you got one of those? He said, you want to? You mean? I said, you mean a Bible? He said, yeah. He says, I said, you ever read it? I says, well, I do for time. I kind of like it. I read it. I said, do you understand it? He says, well, you know, not really, and everything. He says, well, you know, sometimes in order to understand things, you got to do it with a group of people, a group of men, you know, like a Bible study or something. I said, because you know, because I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful for being sober. And you know what? I love people. I love people. I love helping people. You know what I mean? Because you know why? Because I'm close to him, and I perform his work well. Because that's all I care about, his work. And that's what his work is about, helping other people. That's all he cares about, helping other people. And he puts these people in your path to help them. Not to think about yourself, for you to help them. And the bottom line is so I said, so you got one of those? He says, no. He says, I said, well, I'll tell you what. What's your name? He says, my name's Leo. I said, I'll tell you what, Leo. I said, tomorrow morning's Thursday morning. Every Thursday morning at 7:30, I go to a Bible study. As a matter of fact, I bring the bagels to the Bible study. And I said, you see that house over there? And he says, yeah, I see that. He says, that's my house. If you're at my house at 7:30 in the morning, I'll take you over to the Bible study with me. He says, you will? I says, absolutely, I will. I said, you just be over at that house at 7:30 tomorrow morning, around 7:20, something like that. And we'll go to the Bible study. So he said, sure. And he said, so he left. I left. And, I forgot all about it. I mean, I meant it. I was sincere, but I just sort of forgot about it. I went through my day. And so the next morning I woke up, you know, I walked out of my house at around 7:15. And guess who's standing by the car? Leo. With a Bible. I said, hey, how you doing, buddy? He says, fine. He says, can we go to the Bible study? I said, absolutely. Get in the car. So I drive him over to the Bible study. You got him to this Bible study. I start going to the West. That's where I met my third sponsor, the Bible study. He has 58 years, you know. And you go to wherever you have to go to create the fellowship to get the fellowship you need. Because I have guys that come over from NA, that come over to A because they need guys, instead of with like 15, they need guys with 30 years. You know what I mean? And so what I would do is I would go to this Bible study, knowing nothing about it when I was 15 years old, because that's the book they were reading when they started writing the big book and everything like that. And there'd be guys in their 80s and 90s, you know what I mean, that have been reading this stuff for like 40, 50 years, you know what I mean? And it's unbelievable where these guys are. And so I went over there and so I brought Leo over there. And we go through the Bible study thing and, you know, whatever it is. And I think he said something at the end of it, whatever we were studying, he said, he raised his hand, he says, I think Jesus was an alien. But you know, these guys are good Christian men, you know what I mean? So you know what they said to him? You know what they said to him? Keep coming back, kid. They said to him what we said. They said, keep coming back. You know what Bill Wilson's sponsor, you know his real sponsors was Sam Shoemaker, who was the guy who ran Calvary Chapel, who was the Oxford Group guy, and Father Ed Dowling, Jesuit priest. This whole thing is steep. So they said, keep coming back. So we get in the car, and I'm driving him back home, Leo. And he says to me, he says, what do you think? He says, they loved you, kid. They loved you. You were great. And everything like, you know, we're having, and I learned a little bit about, and I learned a little bit about him. I learned that he was a young kid. He was about 16 years old, that his mother was a single mother. He had a three-year-old daughter. She had a three-year-old sister from a different father. You know, his mother had never been married. And he was, you know, he's just like a young kid, 16 years old. No father, no brother, three-year-old, his mother's working, you know what I mean? Just trying to figure out what life is all about, you know what I mean? Like, just figuring out this deal, you know what I mean? And I'm like taking him to a Bible study and showing him this deal, and he said, would you do me a favor? I said, sure, what? He says, would you maybe take me to my house? You know, I said, sure, I'll be happy to. He says, how do I get there? He says, well, drive, you know, where I was at your house, go to your house, and I'll try to get there. So I drove over to my house, and he says, well, now go down the street over there and turn at the stop sign. So I went down the street, and I, I turn to the stop sign. So he says, well, now go down to 54 and turn it left. So I'm going down to 54. So he's directing me how to go, and sooner or later we're about 5, 6, 7 miles away, or whatever that is, 6 miles away, and he says, okay, that's my house. So I say to him, well, it's great seeing you. I hope I see you again, whatever it is. And I said, how'd you get to my house this morning? Who drove you to the house? He says, well, I got up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I showered, and I didn't want to miss it, so I walked over. And I have people in Alcoholics Anonymous say, how can I get this thing? What kind of willingness do I have to have? You know, it's amazing the incredible effect you can have in people's lives just for knowing for a short time. Now, I have no idea where I wish I could tell you. I know where Leo is, whatever it is. I have a lot of guys I sponsor and everything like that. I know where they are and know what their deal is. But I don't know where Leo is. I would like to think that he's doing well wherever he is. And no matter what was going on in his life, I'd like to think that every once in a while, whenever he's reporting to somebody or talking to something or something like that, he maybe mentions one time, there was this guy in Miami, I'll never forget, he took me to my first Bible study. And he really cared about me. And the more I get involved in things like that, doing stuff like that, the more I feel good about myself. I think self-esteem is a rarity for an alcoholic. And then you don't have to tell yourself that you're a piece of crap and you're nothing. And you wish you were dead or any of those voices and crap like that, because you're doing what God wants you to do. And that's what the whole deal is about in this deal. And what's great? What's great is not only there are millions of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that you can help, is that you find when you get a hold of this thing, you find out what it's really about. There's billions of people all over the world, every day you run into them, that suffer from the same crap. Don't kid yourself. The same crap you suffer from. There ain't no original emotions or feelings. They all suffer from the envy, from the coveting. They all suffer from the anger, from the disappointment. They all suffer from the fear of dying, the fear of this, the fear of that. You're on with this program. You love God. You want to help people. It's amazing how much you can help people in this world. And when you help people in this world, you don't have to worry about buying a new purse or getting a new car or spending money you don't have to impress people you don't even like, because you don't have to impress anybody. Because there's no point in it. It's not necessary. Because there's only one person you want to impress, and that's the person that gave you the gift of sobriety in the first place. So God bless you. Thank you very much.